in a world where foreign markets are becoming less important, countries need to rely more on their middle class. And that in turn implies a certain degree of equality.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. In 2021, at the end of her tenure as the president of the Econometric Association, Penny Goldberg of Yale gave a provocative address on what the pathway to development might be in a world of economic nationalism rather than integration. It was recently published in Econometrica, and as the political tide of economic nationalism in high-income countries shows little sign of turning at the moment, there could be no better time to discuss her ideas. Penny, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you for having me.
Penny, I was struck by one of the lines in the paper. It said, India grew fast in the last three decades, but its growth was not driven by manufacturing and certainly not by exports. What was driving it instead?
So you probably expect a one-line summary of the answer, but actually the answer is quite complicated, it's quite nuanced, and it's the subject of research. It's exactly this question that motivated our research, the research that led to the paper you mentioned. I guess most people would say it's services. It's not manufacturing, it's services. It's been the growth of the service sector. But of course, this raises the question of the chicken and the egg. So what came first? Did services grow as incomes grew in India, or is it the other way around? Namely, that service growth led general growth of the economy. It's not easy to tell these two directions apart. There is a paper by some colleagues of mine. So Michael Peters and Fabrizio Ciliboti, and they worked with a graduate student, Fan, at the time, at Yale. And they claim it's actually productivity growth in services that accounts for a large part of the explanation. But it's still up for research.
Many of us have a mental model of development that's based on manufacturing, exports, supply side improvements, growth in trade, and that leads to poverty reduction. Does this require particular conditions that we could obtain in the 1990s, the 2000s, maybe not so much anymore?
Indeed, in the last few decades, growth has been mostly manufacturing led, and trade played a very important role. And the advantage of trade, if you want, is that poor countries don't need to do much to get this process going beyond opening their borders. By that, I don't necessarily mean free trade, but I do mean trade. And the main condition, more than anything else, is the willingness of countries to engage with each other. This willingness was there in the past three decades. And in fact, what defined this era of hyper-globalization was the willingness of countries to trade with each other and engage economically with each other, even if they belong to different political regimes, even if they had completely different political systems, even if we didn't agree with them on ideology and so on. And this has changed fundamentally. So now we see an emergence of economic nationalism, and even when countries try to go beyond economic nationalism, there is a push towards trading with countries that are very much like you. Friendshoring or nearshoring. This is a very different environment that poses challenges, in my opinion, for developing countries and in particular for low-income countries.
So the big beneficiaries from the development process of this previous regime are which countries? I think I can guess one.
Well, the poster children are the East Asian countries. And people think, of course, of China. So China is one example, but there are many others. So the East Asian tigers, more recently Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia, all these countries relied very much on exports and trade and manufacturing. This was not the only thing that accounts for their growth, but it's an important part of the process.
Conditions are different now, which we are going to discuss, but it's not as simple as saying, okay, so it was manufacturing then, you can achieve the same results by using services now.
Well, that has been the hope for a long time. And in fact, this is what led to this project. So when I joined the World Bank, there was this anxiety around, so what's the new model of development? What's the new vision going forward? It was clear to many that we could not rely on manufacturing, so services are the obvious alternative. But now if you look at a continent like Africa, where extreme poverty is still a huge issue, this promise has not materialized. So in many cases, we saw an increase in services, but services are a very broad, very heterogeneous category. And so in many cases in Africa, what people observed is you have growth of cities, you have people moving from rural to urban areas, you have what people called urbanization without industrialization, but this didn't lead to growth, it didn't lead to poverty reduction. And then at the same time, we're observing what happened in India, which seemed much closer to this vision that people had that services could be the new engine of growth. And joined with Tristan Reed of the World Bank, we started asking ourselves, so what makes India different from these other countries that we're thinking about in Africa? And perhaps going forward, the Indian model is more relevant for development and especially for Africa than the East Asian model. So this is how we started working on this project. It was exactly this realization that manufacturing was probably not the way of the future.
So Penny, at the heart of this address, now this paper, is the model that you have developed to try and represent how development might occur in the future. And this was inspired by this time at the World Bank where you were searching for the new model of development, was it?
Very much so. So let me be clear, this is not a policy paper. So we didn't write this paper because we were trying to tell countries what to do. It was motivated by true curiosity as to what is the new vision of development right now. In particular, when I joined the bank, that was the end of 2018. And that's when the US had just imposed tariffs on China. And then China retaliated. So we still have the US-China trade war. In addition to the fact that manufacturing did not seem very promising, we had the emergence of trade tensions and trade wars and the emergence of economic nationalism across the world. That led to this additional question that how can developing countries develop or go forward in a world where there is much more nationalism? Given these new challenges, what is the path forward?
For the purpose of what we're discussing today, what do we mean by development?
So development is a very broad term. Needless to say, there are many aspects to development. So in our work, we started with a very basic definition. Namely, we defined development as elimination of extreme poverty. At the time we wrote the paper, the extreme poverty line set by the World Bank was $1.90 per day in purchasing power parity terms. If a country eliminates extreme poverty, this doesn't mean, of course, that this is an advanced country, as we say, but we would consider that to be the first step. It's always been one of the important goals of the World Bank, of the UN, and simply put, you don't observe any advanced countries that still have extreme poverty. For the purposes of our paper, this is how it's defined. Needless to say, as countries grow, as they eliminate extreme poverty, there is much more that goes into development.
And in this concept of development, there is still a role, is there, for these supply-side improvements that have driven the development of so many countries over the past 30 years?
Of course, we are economists, and as economists, we always think in equilibrium terms, so demand has to equal supply. So of course, supply is important. And we didn't mean to say in the paper, when we emphasize the demand side, that all one needs to do is focus on the demand. Our point was simply that right now, given the conditions we observe, the demand side has become more of the binding constraint. But the supply remains important. And what I mean by supply is, for example, policies that countries can implement in order to increase the supply of skilled workers, improve the quality of the labor force, provide a better match of the skills that people have and what the industry needs, provide physical infrastructure, capital market integration. I think of all these policies as being policies that tend to target more the supply side. And of course, these are very important. And of course, productivity improvements, adoptions of new technology, all this is extremely important.
But in the title of the paper and in the argument of it, we are thinking about the demand side constraints. And in a world where trading partners are much more selective about how they do business and who they do business with. Where does demand come from?
Let me say at the outset, we didn't start writing this paper as a trade paper. In fact, trade was not in our mind at all. The question, as you said, was precisely that, where will the demand come from if we don't have much trade?
Yeah.
And in the end, we came away with an increased appreciation of what trade had done in the past for low-income countries, because the simple answer is that if you're a small country, and by small, I mean in terms of market size, then it's extremely hard to eliminate poverty without connecting to foreign markets. In a world where foreign markets are shrinking for many reasons, some of them are structural reasons, some of them are political reasons, countries have no other option than to turn to the domestic market. Having a sizable, healthy middle class is key. The middle class has been emphasized many times before in the literature for many different reasons. In some work, people attribute great qualities to the middle class. For example, the willingness to save, the willingness to defer consumption. They often associate the middle class with certain values that may be important for development. For example, people want to educate their children. In our framework, the middle class is important for one and only reason: their purchasing power. They're consumers. They tend to buy products that are mass produced. These products in our framework are produced by firms that make profits. These profits go back to the middle class. So the middle class are defined as people who own shares of firms. And that means that they participate in the generation in the profit distribution. Mm-hmm. And so that sets off a virtuous cycle. As the economy grows, there are more profits. These profits come back to the middle class. The middle class consumes. And as it consumes, the economy grows further. In a world where foreign markets are becoming less important, countries need to rely more on their middle class. And to a certain extent, I think this was the case in India, for example. And that in turn implies a certain degree of equality. Equality has a very specific meaning in our framework. We don't mean complete equality, mm-hmm. because if a country is very poor and completely equal, then it will never get out of poverty. Equality in our context means you don't want an economy where the wealth is held in the hands of very few. Then you may see growth in official statistics, you may see booms, but you're not going to see sustainable development and poverty reduction.
When you take this model to the data, what sort of data can you use to capture those two sources of demand, the international and the domestic?
We use panel data for several countries between 1980 and 2015. We try to focus on relatively recent years. We define the middle class as people in each economy who earn between $11 and $110 per day. Mm-hmm. This is actually a definition adopted from another paper by Karas. And the idea is that if you're in the global middle class, you don't want to be rich in a rich country and you don't want to be poor in the poorest of rich countries. So essentially, these are the thresholds for the poor in countries like Portugal or Italy, which are the poorest rich countries. And the upper bound, the 110, refers to Luxembourg, which consider to be one of the richer rich countries. So you want your income to be in between. For the international market size, we use trade agreements. We use signed trade agreements that each country has with all possible trading partners. So this include the WTO, before the WTO, the GATT, but also preferential trade agreements, regional trade agreements. We use that to create weights that capture how many provisions countries signed, to what extent are they integrated with their trading partners. And then we create two different measures. We sum up the populations of all trading partners, weighted by these weights that reflect trade agreements. And we also look at the per capita income of all trading partners. So we have two different measures. One captures the market size as reflected by the total population that the country connects to. And the other measure captures the purchasing power of all trading partners. And it turns out that's quite important. And the reason is we find that the purchasing power of the trading partners is what's most important. So in other words, it's not enough to connect to the whole world if the whole world is poor. What you really want to do is connect to lucrative export markets. Think about what happened in Vietnam in 2001. Mm-hmm. Vietnam signs a bilateral trade agreement with the US, and all of a sudden the US market is available to Vietnam. To a certain extent, China benefited tremendously when it connected to Europe and the United States. And this is precisely the challenge that poor countries face today, that these markets become less available because of economic nationalism.
Yeah, you were able to run some counterfactuals using this model. You mentioned earlier the emergence of these concepts like nearshoring and friendshoring, where rich countries prefer to do business with people who are ideologically similar or geographically closer. What can the model tell us about the impact of the emergence of these concepts?
The model speaks directly to this issue. So first, as I pointed out before, the model implies trade is very important. Mm-hmm. Without trade for poor countries, it's extremely hard to reduce extreme poverty. And of course, people are saying, well, no one is considering autarky here. I mean, this is just a notional counterfactual. It's not a policy counterfactual. What the model also tells us is that it matters whether you connect with richer, with lucrative markets, or with markets that have approximately the same per capita income that you have. What's happening now is it will become in the future harder to connect to richer countries now. Why is that? So we see a push for friendshoring for many different reasons. So one is national security or geopolitics. And if you look at the data and you consider who is considered to be a friend of, let's say, the United States, for the most part, it's countries that are very similar to the United States. It's mostly European countries. It's mostly advanced countries. There are some exceptions to this pattern. I guess policymakers in the US consider Vietnam a friend right now. The population at large still doesn't consider Vietnam a friend. In survey data, there is a very strong pro-European cultural bias. The other factors are also objectives that most of us would consider worthwhile. So, for example, labor standards, environmental standards, climate change. No one questions that all this is important. But again, if we make those a condition for trade, in other words, we trade only with countries that have the same labor standards or same environmental standards. But let's say there is a CBAM, carbon border adjustment mechanism, mm-hmm. all this is going to shift trade towards trade among similar countries, among advanced countries. Maybe this is what we need to do if we are going to try to address issues such as climate change or equality within our own countries. But at the same time, one needs to recognize that the low-income countries are going to pay a price. One option that many countries still have is regional agreements, regional trading blocks. That's also a form of integration. It's not going to be as helpful as connections to rich markets, but still consider the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. It's a step in the right direction because at least it generates a bigger market.
And if they're paying the price and they have to replace that with domestic demand, what does your work tell us about how they can generate that domestic demand, where it can come from?
That's a very good question. What can they do domestically? So I emphasize the role of the middle class. And the question is, how do you generate this middle class? In our framework, what's important is that this middle class owns shares. So that implies that the best policies are not the ones that focus on income redistribution, but wealth redistribution. In other words, you don't particularly care about income top-ups. You care about distributing the wealth more equally across people, across workers, across households. It's perhaps a very drastic solution, but it's not something that has been inconceivable in the past in many developing countries. Well, Vietnam, in the Doi Moi reforms, one of the early steps was to redistribute land so that every farmer had some land. And the main reason they did that was to incentivize farmers to invest in the land and to increase productivity. But in addition to that, that created a more equal distribution of land. So this is one example. Land redistribution is another policy that creates a more equal distribution of wealth, making sure that people have equity shares, for example, they participate in stock markets. So these are the kind of policies through the lens of our model that would actually help increase the size of the middle class, more so than income transfers.
Penny, you contrast what's happened in India in your paper with what hasn't happened in Nigeria as a good example. It's not only conceptually very difficult for policy to generate a strong middle class somewhere like Nigeria, it's practically extremely difficult as well, isn't it, with quite a low tax base. How do policymakers start on that journey?
Needless to say, it's extremely challenging. So especially in Africa, when there is no state capacity, and that's always the question, there is no tax base. But this is why I said this is not about income redistribution in our framework. It's about wealth redistribution. That doesn't necessarily require tax revenues. It requires the willingness to take the wealth from very few and make sure it's distributed more equally across the population. That's one example. As I said before, this is not a policy paper. More than anything else, we wanted to identify a problem. And then I think it's up to the policymakers to see how they can address the situation in the particular settings they work in.
And in a setting, for example, like the World Bank, where there are policy recommendations, is it possible that what you have identified here is also identifying that they could get stuck in a situation where the policy recommendations are not sufficient anymore to create the growth that's intended, the development that's intended for them?
I think the World Bank realizes the importance of the demand side. So there is a big initiative called Jobs. Where will the jobs come from? Essentially, this is the question we ask in the paper. You can provide capital infrastructure, you can increase human capital, but ultimately, what is going to generate jobs, good jobs in an economy? On the other hand, I think the World Bank right now, especially when I entered, it found itself in a very difficult position. Along with the IMF, these institutions have always been strong advocates of trade. And then they found themselves in the midst of increasing trade tensions between the US and China. This has become only worse. It's very hard for everyone to navigate these waters right now. I think sometime consistency is needed. What I mean by that is, let's not forget what advice all these institutions were giving to these countries until a few years ago.
Penny Goldberg, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
The paper is published in Econometrica, as I said, volume 91, number 6. That was in November 2023. It's called Demand Side Constraints in Development, The Role of Market Size, Trade and Inequality. And the authors, Penny Goldberg and Tristan Reed. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org.